We are stepping back over 2,500 years to a time of profound turbulence. Imagine a China fractured into warring states, where the old social contracts had dissolved, and violence was the primary language of politics. It was the spring and autumn period, a time when the very concept of civilization seemed on the brink of collapse. Into this chaos stepped a man named Kong Chu, known to the world as Confucius. He was not a conqueror. He had no standing army, no divine mandate, and no magical powers. In fact, by many standards of his time, he was a failure. He spent his life traveling from court to court, rejected by rulers who preferred the quick fix of force over the slow work of virtue. He died believing his mission had ended in disappointment. Yet, paradoxically, that failure became the bedrock of East Asian civilization for 2.5 millennia. Why? Because Confucius offered a radical alternative to the violence of his age. While others sought to control people through fear and strict laws, he argued that true order comes from within. He believed that if we cultivate our own character, if we learn to be Ren, benevolent, to practice Li, proper ritual, and to honor our families, we don't just improve ourselves, we heal society. Alright, so here's someone you need to know about. Not because he conquered empires or built monuments, but because he figured out something that would shape how billions of people think about being human. Confucius, 551 to 479 BCE, China's spring and autumn period, which sounds peaceful, but was anything but. Picture this, kingdoms constantly at war, social order collapsing, people wondering if civilization itself might just fall apart. And into this chaos walks this guy who thinks the answer isn't bigger armies or stricter laws. The answer, he says, is becoming better people. Now, Confucius wasn't born into power. He held some minor government positions, nothing spectacular. But what he really did, what earned him the title First Teacher, was gather students and teach them how to live. Not just survive, but live with purpose, with virtue, with genuine humanity. His disciples took notes. They compiled his wisdom into what we call the Analects. And those conversations, those questions and answers between a teacher and his students, became the philosophical foundation for entire civilizations for over 2,500 years. But here's what makes it stick. He didn't write a manifesto. He didn't claim divine revelation. He spoke in fragments, in metaphors, in responses to specific situations. That's why the Analects read less like a textbook and more like overhearing a wise man at dinner. But we need to understand why his ideas caught fire. Because they didn't emerge in a vacuum. They were a direct response to crisis. The spring and autumn period was chaos. I'm talking about a time when the old feudal order was crumbling, when different states were constantly fighting, when people didn't know what rules applied anymore or who to trust. It was the kind of era that makes people desperate for answers, and answers came. This period gave rise to what historians call the 100 schools of thought, competing philosophies all trying to solve the same problem. How do we fix this broken society? Some said, more laws, stricter punishments. That's legalism, rule through fear and control. Others said, forget society, return to nature. That's Taoism, step back from the artificial complexity of civilization. Still others offered military strategies, logical systems, different paths to order. But here's what makes Confucius different, what makes his approach remarkable. He didn't want to control people through fear or abandon society altogether. He wanted to transform people from the inside out. He believed, and this is radical, that if you could cultivate virtue in individuals, if you could teach people to genuinely care about each other and act with proper conduct, you wouldn't need harsh laws or authoritarian control. Social harmony would emerge naturally from cultivated character. Think about that. In an age of violence and disorder, he's proposing that the solution is education and moral development. Not force. Not manipulation, genuine human goodness carefully cultivated through teaching and practice. And the crazy thing? It worked. His ideas became central to Chinese culture, governance, and social structure for over 2 millennia. They shaped Korea, Japan, Vietnam. They influenced how hundreds of millions of people thought about family, duty, leadership, and what it means to be human. All because one teacher in one chaotic era believed that people could be better than they were, and showed them how. So if Confucius is going to transform society from the inside out, he needs to start with something fundamental. And for him, that something is Ren. Now, this character, Ren, is fascinating. It combines the symbol for person with the symbol for two. Think about that. Humanity isn't something you achieve alone. It's inherently relational. It's about how you treat other people. Ren gets translated as benevolence, humanness, compassion, but really, it's bigger than any single English word. It's the quality that makes us genuinely human. Not just biologically human, but morally human. It's that deep capacity for empathy, for putting yourself in someone else's position and actually caring about their well-being. Here's what Confucius says about it. A man of Ren wishes to establish his own character and also helps others to be prominent. You catch that? It's not just about being a good person yourself. True Ren means you want others to flourish too. You're not competing for moral superiority. You're lifting others up as you rise. This is the supreme virtue in Confucian thought. Everything else flows from this. Because without genuine compassion, without that fundamental concern for others, all your rituals become empty gestures. All your proper behavior becomes performance. You might look virtuous from the outside, but you're hollow inside. Confucius understood something profound. You can't legislate goodness into people. You can't force someone to care. But you can cultivate it. You can teach it. You can model it. And when Ren takes root in someone's character, everything else follows naturally. That's why he called it the foundation of morality. Without Ren, you're just going through the motions. With it, you become fully human. But, and here's where Confucius gets really interesting, Ren by itself isn't enough. You need structure. You need form. You need lie. Li is usually translated as ritual or propriety, but that makes it sound stuffy and formal. What Confucius means is much more dynamic. Li is the entire framework of proper conduct. How you behave in relationships, how you show respect, how you navigate social situations, how you perform ceremonies, how you interact with family, friends, authorities. It's the structure that gives your inner virtue outward expression. Now here's the brilliant part. The thing that shows Confucius wasn't just some rigid traditionalist. He believed that practicing Li actually transforms you. It's not just about following rules for the sake of rules. When you consistently practice proper conduct, when you bow respectfully, when you speak courteously, when you perform rituals with genuine attention, you're training your character. Think of it like muscle memory, but for virtue. You practice the external forms, and gradually they shape your internal reality. The respect you show externally becomes genuine internal respect. The care you demonstrate in ritual becomes authentic care in your heart. This is why Confucius thought that when people truly internalize Li, society needs fewer laws and punishments. Harmony emerges organically. You don't need police on every corner if people have cultivated the habit of treating each other properly. But, and this is crucial, Li without Ren is worthless. If you're just going through the motions, if there's no genuine compassion behind your proper behavior, you're a hypocrite. You're performing virtue rather than embodying it. That's the balance Confucius is after. Ren provides the heart, the genuine concern for others. Li provides the form, the structured way to express that concern. Together they create what Confucius calls the junzi, the superior person, the exemplary human being. One without the other fails. Ren without Li is formless compassion that doesn't know how to act. Li without Ren is empty ritual that looks good but means nothing. But when you bring them together, when you have genuine compassion expressed through proper conduct, that's when you start to see what Confucius envisioned. Individuals who naturally create harmony wherever they go, not because they're forced to, but because virtue has become their second nature. And that's not just philosophy. That's practical wisdom for building a society where people actually want to live. All right, so we've got Ren, genuine compassion, and Li, proper conduct. But where does all this moral cultivation actually begin? Where's the training ground for becoming a virtuous person? For Confucius, the answer is crystal clear. It starts at home. With your family, specifically with Xiao, filial piety. Now I know filial piety sounds ancient and maybe a bit foreign to modern ears. But stay with me, because what Confucius is talking about here is actually the root system for all human relationships. Xiao means deep respect and devotion to your parents and ancestors. But it's not just abstract respect. It's lived, practical, daily care. It's obedience when you're young. It's taking care of your parents when they're old. It's honoring their memory after they're gone. It's remembering where you came from and who made your existence possible. Here's Confucius's logic, and it's pretty compelling. If you can't learn to care for the people who gave you life, who raised you, who sacrificed for you, the people right in front of you, how are you going to care about strangers? How are you going to develop genuine compassion for society at large? Family is the laboratory for virtue. It's where you first learn what it means to put someone else's needs before your own. Where you learn patience, sacrifice, loyalty, love that isn't based on what you get in return. And this isn't just theory for Confucius. Throughout East Asia, you still see this lived out. Qingming Festival, Tomb Sweeping Day, where families visit ancestral graves, clean them, leave offerings. Not because they think their ancestors need food, but because remembering matters. Because gratitude matters. Because recognizing that you're part of something larger than yourself matters. Confucius's birthday is celebrated as Teacher's Day in many Asian countries. Why? Because the relationship between teacher and student mirrors the parent-child relationship. Both are about transmission, passing on wisdom, values, ways of being human. But here's what's really interesting. Confucius isn't saying family comes before everything else no matter what. Remember, this all has to be grounded in Ren, genuine compassion and righteousness. If your parents ask you to do something immoral, you don't just obey blindly. You respectfully try to guide them back to virtue. Xiao isn't about blind obedience. It's about recognizing that our capacity for moral relationship begins in the family and radiates outward. Master the art of caring for your parents, and you've laid the foundation for caring about your community, your society, humanity itself. It's the root of harmony. And without strong roots, nothing grows properly. So here's the question. If you cultivate Ren, practice Li, honor Xiao, what do you become? What's the goal of all this moral development? Confucius calls it the Junzi, usually translated as the superior man or the gentleman. But really, we're talking about the exemplary human being, the person who embodies what it means to be fully, authentically human. And here's what's revolutionary about this concept. The Junzi isn't superior because of birth or wealth or power. You don't become a Junzi by being born into the right family or accumulating money or conquering territory. You become a Junzi through moral cultivation, through character development, through genuine virtue. In Confucius's time, Junzi literally meant son of a ruler. It was a term for nobility. But Confucius takes this aristocratic term and democratizes it. He says, essentially, real nobility has nothing to do with your bloodline. It's about who you are as a person. Look at what defines the Junzi. Wisdom. Deep understanding of moral principles, not just book knowledge. Righteousness. Unwavering commitment to what's right, even when it's difficult or unpopular. Courage, the strength to stand by your convictions when everyone else is compromising. Benevolence, that compassion toward all beings we talked about with Ren. The Junzi lives by principles rather than personal gain. When everyone else is asking, what's in it for me? The Junzi is asking, what's the right thing to do? And here's the thing about the Junzi that makes this so practical. They lead by example. They don't need to force people to follow them. Their character is so compelling, their integrity so obvious that people naturally want to emulate them. Confucius says the Junzi is like the wind, and ordinary people are like grass. When the wind blows, the grass bends. Not because it's forced to, but because that's the natural response to a powerful force. That's moral leadership. That's the kind of influence that doesn't require armies or police states or propaganda. It's the influence that comes from being genuinely good and letting that goodness speak for itself. Now, contrast this with the Xiaoren, the small person, the petty person. The Xiaoren is driven by profit, by self-interest, by what looks good rather than what is good. The Xiaoren follows the crowd, bends with whatever pressure is strongest at the moment, has no internal compass. We've all met both types, right? The person whose integrity is unshakable versus the person who changes positions based on what's convenient. The person who inspires you to be better versus the person who brings out your worst impulses. Confucius isn't naive about this. He knows becoming a Junzi is hard work. It requires constant self-examination, constant effort to align your actions with your principles, constant practice of virtue until it becomes natural. But that's the goal. That's what all this philosophy is aiming at. Creating people who don't need to be controlled because they've learned to govern themselves. People who create harmony naturally because virtue has become their character. And when you have enough Junzi in society, people of genuine moral character in positions of influence, that's when you get the kind of social harmony Confucius envisioned. Not imposed from above, but emerging naturally from the bottom up. That's the vision. That's what we're building toward with all these concepts we've been exploring. Okay, so we've got these principles, Ren, Li, Xiao, and we've got this ideal of the Junzi. But how does this actually work in practice? How do you organize a society around virtue? Confucius gives us a blueprint. Five fundamental relationships that, when properly maintained, create social harmony. And what's fascinating is how specific he gets about each one. First, father and son. This is the prototype, the original relationship that teaches us everything else. It's loving and reverential. The parent provides care, guidance, wisdom. The child offers respect, obedience, gratitude. Notice it goes both ways. The parent has responsibilities too. You can't just demand respect. You have to earn it through genuine care. Second, elder and younger brother. Gentle and respectful. The older sibling guides with kindness, not tyranny. The younger follows with deference, not resentment. It's about learning hierarchy that isn't oppressive, where authority comes with the responsibility to nurture. Third, husband and wife. Good in listening. Now, we have to acknowledge this gets complicated in modern contexts. Confucius was working within a patriarchal society, no question. But the core principle, mutual respect, harmony through understanding, partnership rather than domination, that transcends the historical limitations. Fourth, older and younger friend, considerate and deferential. Even in friendship, there's recognition that wisdom comes with experience, but it's balanced. The older friend doesn't lord it over the younger. The younger doesn't dismiss the older's insights. It's friendship elevated by mutual learning. Fifth, ruler and subject, benevolent and loyal. And this one's crucial because it shows Confucius wasn't just about obedience to authority. The ruler has the first responsibility to govern with virtue, to care for the people. Only then does the subject owe loyalty. It's a contract, not a one-way street. Here's what's brilliant about this framework. Every relationship has reciprocal duties. It's never just obey your superiors. It's always those with authority must earn respect through virtue, and those who receive care must respond with gratitude and loyalty. And notice how they nest inside each other. You learn respect in the family, then extend it to friends, then to society, then to governance. Each relationship trains you for the next level of social complexity. But here's the thing nobody talks about enough. These aren't rigid rules. They're dynamic relationships that require constant attention and adjustment. The father-son relationship changes as the son grows up. The ruler-subject relationship depends entirely on whether the ruler is actually governing virtuously. Confucius understood that social harmony isn't about everyone staying in their place forever. It's about everyone fulfilling their role with genuine virtue, and those roles evolving as circumstances change. When these five relationships function properly, when they're grounded in Ren and expressed through Lai, you get what Confucius called the Great Harmony. Not uniformity, not everyone being the same, but everyone contributing their unique role to the larger symphony of society. And when they break down, when fathers abuse rather than guide, when rulers exploit rather than serve, when friends betray rather than support, that's when you get the chaos Confucius witnessed in his own time. These relationships are the architecture of a functioning society. Get them right, and everything else follows. So let's talk about what actually happened with these ideas. Because this isn't just ancient history, this is a living tradition that shaped civilizations. Chinese civilization, for over two millennia, Confucianism was the foundation of Chinese culture. The imperial examination system, which selected government officials based on their knowledge of Confucian texts, lasted from the 7th century until 1905. Think about that. For over 1,000 years, if you wanted political power in China, you had to master Confucian philosophy. That's not indoctrination, that's a civilization saying, we want our leaders to be scholars of virtue, not just warriors or aristocrats. The system had its flaws, absolutely. But the core idea, that governance requires moral education, that's remarkable. Confucianism shaped education systems, family values, social etiquette, concepts of duty and honor. It became so woven into the fabric of Chinese culture that it's hard to separate Confucian influence from Chinese identity itself, regional influence, but it didn't stop at China's borders. Korea adopted Confucianism and in some ways became even more Confucian than China. The emphasis on education, on respect for elders, on social harmony, these became defining features of Korean culture. Japan integrated Confucian principles with Buddhism and Shinto, creating a unique synthesis. The Samurai Code of Bushido, heavily influenced by Confucian concepts of loyalty, duty, and proper conduct. Vietnam, despite centuries of resistance to Chinese political control, embraced Confucian philosophy, It shaped Vietnamese family structure, education, and social organization. Across East Asia, you see common threads: high value placed on education, deep respect for teachers, strong family bonds, emphasis on social harmony over individual assertion, belief that moral cultivation is everyone's responsibility. Modern relevance. Now here's where it gets really interesting. In the 20th century, Confucianism took some hits. Revolutionary movements in China blamed it for holding the country back. Modernizers argued it was incompatible with democracy and individual rights. But something fascinating happened. As East Asian economies boomed, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and now China, scholars started asking, what cultural factors contributed to this success? And they kept coming back to Confucian values. The emphasis on education? That creates highly skilled workforces. The focus on social harmony? That facilitates cooperation and long-term planning. The respect for authority balanced with expectation of virtuous leadership? That can create stable, effective governance when it works properly. Today, Confucius Institutes operate in over 500 locations worldwide, teaching Chinese language and culture. Confucius's birthday is celebrated as Teacher's Day across Asia. His ideas inform contemporary discussions about business ethics, political philosophy, education reform, and community building. And here's what's remarkable. These aren't just Asian conversations anymore. Western philosophers and ethicists are increasingly engaging with Confucian thought, finding insights that complement or challenge Western ethical traditions. The emphasis on relationships over individual autonomy? That's offering alternatives to Western individualism. The focus on virtue cultivation rather than rule following? That's enriching contemporary virtue ethics. The belief that education shapes character, not just knowledge? That's influencing educational philosophy worldwide. Confucius lived 2,500 years ago in a chaotic corner of ancient China. But his ideas about what makes us human, how we should treat each other, and how society can achieve genuine harmony, those ideas are still shaping how billions of people think about morality, leadership, and the good life. That's not just historical influence, that's philosophical immortality.